Nat Turner's Rebellion, the slave uprising in Virginia in which 60 whites were killed, hundreds more blacks killed in retaliation when it was put down, is the subject of the new film The Birth of a Nation. Nate Parker stars as Turner. He co-wrote, co-directed, and co-produced the film. It's won raves, but that's been somewhat overshadowed by a long-ago rape charge Parker was cleared of. His accuser killed herself in 2012. Terrible story. But what is true about Nat Turner? He was a minister. In this scene from the new film, a white preacher criticizes him for baptizing a white man.
Exhort servants to be obedient to their own masters and to please them well in all things, not answering
again. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men.
He that shall blaspheme against the Holy Ghost hath never forgiveness. But is in danger.
Beware of false prophets who come dressed in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves.
A scene from the new film Birth of a Nation, the title taken from D.W. Griffith's silent racist 1915 film, which assigned the birth of the nation to the Ku Klux Klan. On 60 Minutes, Nate Parker said he's trying to reframe that.
In the same way that I'm reclaiming the title, I'm reclaiming a hero. You know, Nat Turner birthed a nation of resistors. Of people that were truly willing to die for absolute freedom and liberation.
Parker's film is loosely based on earlier writing. In 1831, a white lawyer for the now jailed slaves interviewed Nat Turner for his Confessions of Nat Turner. In the 60s, author William Styron wrote a fictionalized account, which was rejected by black scholars, especially because of the way it portrayed his friendship with a flirtatious blonde abolitionist. Manisha Sinha is the author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, and the Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And start with what we know of the real Nat Turner, a literate slave in Southampton, Virginia. Did he also believe himself a prophet? What do we know?
What's interesting about him is that he did visualize himself as the Christian prophet who would free the slaves. And that is how he started the rebellion. He had these visions, these religious visions that told him he needed to start a rebellion. And of course, what's interesting also is that he wanted to start his rebellion on the 4th of July. He fell ill and then they had to postpone it until August. But the fact that he would choose July 4th tells me that he also saw himself as a revolutionary.
Well, and the story that Nate Parker tells is based on the Confessions of Nat Turner by Thomas Ruffin Gray. Now, he was a lawyer for other slaves that took part in the rebellion. But what did he write?
Well, the Confessions of Nat Turner is a very interesting document because Thomas Gray, the white Southern lawyer who recorded it, was clearly looking to make some money. He copyrighted it quickly and then sold, you know, hundreds of copies of it. And you can see in parts of that confession where Gray's voice has emerged. But the most interesting part of those confessions and where you can really see Nat Turner's voice emerge is when Gray asked him, "Are you sorry for what you did now that you're facing execution?" And Nat Turner turned around and tells him, "Was not Christ crucified?"
Well, but how do we know if we think some of it is embellished? How do you know that Nat Turner said that?
So, for instance, in the Confessions of Nat Turner, Thomas Gray kind of begins with Nat Turner telling him that his master, Joseph Travers, was a very kind and good master to him. Now, this is clearly something that Gray is putting in because the first thing that Nat Turner did when he started with his rebellion was basically to kill his master and his family. So you can imagine that Turner was not particularly fond of his master. So there are ways in which we use other documents, other evidence from the period to try to figure out whose voice we are reading. And of course, it's a tricky business, but it's a skill of doing historical research.
Well, even trickier becomes fictionalizing these events, which is what both Nate Parker and William Styron in the 60s did. His Confessions of Nat Turner was a fictionalized novel. He felt that the lawyer Gray had completely gotten Turner wrong. He said Gray's text showed Turner, Nat Turner, as a dangerous religious lunatic, a psychopathic monster. Styron created a character that was almost saintly.
Well, Styron's character of Nat Turner was also somewhat problematic. And you know the controversy it gave rise to. Mm-hmm. You know, he portrays Nat Turner as somebody who is motivated more by his lust for white women than for the liberation of the race. And that, of course, in the 1960s was a red flag for many African-American intellectuals, writers, historians, and scholars who wrote a lengthy response to Styron, whose book was being feted and had won the Pulitzer.
Yeah, that book of essays was called William Styron's Nat Turner, 10 Black Writers Respond, and it was viciously. But I find it interesting because, for instance, the New York Times describes Styron's depiction of Nat Turner as we said, describing him as someone who was pious, saintly, with no romantic entanglements.
There were scenes in the book that actually a lot of African-American intellectuals took objection to. You know, the problem with Styron's confessions is that, yes, of course, he's a novelist and he could take liberties and imagine the Nat Turner that he wanted to, but it was so far removed from the historical record. I don't think it's just a matter of, you know, poaching of territories, etc. I think African-Americans were truly offended by Styron's portrayal of Nat Turner, where he completely domesticated Turner. He was no longer the slave rebel that comes to us across the historical record. So even the confessions that Thomas Gray recorded, you know, he's repulsed by Turner and by his deeds, but he can't help towards the end of the confessions sort of reveal a grudging admiration for Turner. So he describes Turner. He says, you know, clearly he's very intelligent. And then he has this image of Turner in chains, in shackles, in rags, in the jail, raising his hands up to the heavens in defiance. And clearly Gray is writing this very much, you know, in contravention to what he was saying earlier on about Nat Turner. You can literally parse out how Gray is viewing Turner, how Turner's voice emerges within those confessions, and what that one document can tell us, give us kind of a keyhole into Turner's mind and his motivations.
Well, this brings us to Nate Parker's new film, The Birth of a Nation. Now, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, in one of his terrific columns in The Hollywood Reporter, does an essay on it. And his criticism of the new film is that it also takes out some of the nuance of Nat Turner. It portrays the whites as all bad and the blacks as all saintly. When he points out that, for instance, Nat Turner's rebels killed 10 men, but 14 women and 31 infants and children. Mm-hmm. And as Jabbar says, that's a harsh reality that should be acknowledged rather than buried in the film, as he says it is, because it says a lot about the effects of dehumanizing people until they're left with no other option but behaving inhumanely. That to show some of the horror of what happened on the part of Nat Turner shows how far he was driven.
I am a great believer in the Gandhian slogan that, you know, the use of violence dehumanizes everyone. But to understand the situation of enslaved people, one should also understand the daily violence that was slavery. And this is why abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison, who's a complete pacifist, believes in nonviolence in principle, condemns not Nat Turner, but his persecutors. When the rebellion is suppressed and, 50 enslaved people are tried, 30 are sentenced to death, 19 are hanged, including Nat Turner. And in the aftermath of that, there's open season on black people, free and enslaved in that area. Over 300 African Americans actually left that area and went to Liberia, fearing for their lives because of that massive repression that also took place. So there's violence everywhere. And clearly Nat Turner had kind of a no quarters given rebellion. He killed not just, as you said, men, but also women and children. And it's kind of sparing nobody who is identified with the slaveholding class, including children. Don't forget that Nat Turner was technically owned actually by a white child. But his master was Joseph Travis, while that child reached majority. So it's not clear to me that we should pick on the violence of Nat Turner's rebellion in isolation, that we should really be able to understand it in the context of slavery, which was actually a system maintained by terrible everyday violence, and also look at the ways in which the state, which should hold itself accountable to certain laws and due process, also reacted extremely violently to suppress this rebellion, and how whites in the area then sort of took out their wrath on innocent and unsuspecting African Americans. Yeah. We think hundreds of African Americans, both enslaved and free, were actually lynched and killed in the aftermath of Nat Turner's rebellion.
Well, and that's, I think, the point that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is making, which is we need to see the violence that Nat Turner was reacting to understand it, and to understand its legacy today. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Manisha Sinha, author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, and the Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut. Professor, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Birth of a Nation, the new telling of the story of Nat Turner, opens this weekend. You're listening to Here and Now.